Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Access Point. You know it's Thursday. The Access Point is where we examine real challenges Black and Brown, aspiring and experienced professionals face at work and offer expert advice on dealing with your organization, your boss, your coworkers, and your career. I am Dr. Wendy M. Edmonds, author, followership coach, and assistant professor with a research focus on toxic followership. Why do people follow bad people? I am so not by myself. I have my wonderful, awesome co-host, Dr. Lonnie Morris Jr.
Dr. Wendy, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. I am Dr. Lonnie Morris. I am a management consultant and professor, and I spend my time helping really talented people unpack excruciating challenges in organizations. So it brings me great pleasure to bring all of this stuff here to talk with you at the Access Point.
We have a disclaimer. The thoughts and views expressed in tonight's discussion do not reflect the views of any organization with which the hosts or guests may be affiliated. And with that, let's get started.
And we need that disclaimer today because it's going to be a good one. Today's show is about taking up space. And we're really talking about what it's like for Black and Brown professionals to be the only or maybe one of few people of color or Black people or Latino people within the space in which they're working and how to navigate those spaces, how to survive the burden that you may feel, how to move beyond the requirements and the pressure of that, and how to shine without cracking under that pressure. And to help us in this discussion today, we have an extraordinary professional with us, and I'm going to apologize if I butcher your last name, Bernard, because I did not get that from you. I'm going to let you correct me later. You can tell me right now.
It's Guignard. So
Guignard. Like, and that's what I was going to say, but thank you. So no, our guest today is Bernard Guignard, who is a DEI practitioner and expert who spent most of his career in this space. He is former head of diversity and inclusion at Goodwin Procter, a global law firm, and has extensive experience in diversity, organizational strategy, change, and training. He brings a cross-sectional expertise and passion for creating inclusive workspaces and cultures to all of his role. He's held roles at Blue Shield of California, Ropes and Gray, and PwC. He earned a BA in psychology from Temple University. I'm from right around there. He's an active leader, volunteer, and contributor to nonprofit organizations that advocate for improving urban education, near and dear to my heart. Also a founding member and former advisory board member of the Academy of Innovative Technology, a small Brooklyn-based high school. Bernard, welcome to the Access Point.
Thank you, Lonnie. I'm excited to be here.
Is there anything I missed in the bio that you want to add?
No, I think you covered it. I think, I've just grown up in a space around DEI throughout my entire career. So I think you nailed it, what I've done, where I've been. We could just jump into it, and maybe I'll just bring out some other tidbits as the conversation evolves.
All right, that's fair. So I want to kick us off today. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge two really weird things that happened this past week. Maybe not so weird, but challenging things that happened in the past week. The first we saw with the two young Black Tennessee representatives expelled from the House for protesting. So we know that there was this massive shooting in Tennessee, and we had some lawmakers who were trying to move things on the floor, and they protested because their counterparts were moving the agenda. And so there were three who apparently violated the decorum rules for the House, but only two were expelled, the two freshmen who were both young Black men. So that's one thing. And I want to pair that with, and this sort of got dispelled a little, but I saw this in Black Enterprise. So there's a company out of Virginia, Author Grand Technologies. And what happened is they've said now in their statements that this was an ex-employee. But what happened was someone took a job posting and wrote on the job posting that this was for only U.S.-born citizens and they had to be white and circulated that. And the organization is now dispelled that it never came from the organization. It never came from their partner who deals with their postings, but said this was an disgruntled ex-employee who posted it on their own personal social media, but it hit and it took off. And people were talking about this throughout. What is it like to have inclusive spaces, and what are we dealing with racism if this is the lens through which people are seeing even recruiting? So I start with those two things to sort of situate us in the space. And I pose this question for both of you. Why are we even having this conversation, right? So what when we're talking about being the only or one of few, what does that look like? What are we describing for people? And what is that experience? Bernard, why don't you start us off?
Well, the way I look at it is we're still the only in the few because there's still a divide. There is still an assumption that we're all getting along. In addition to that, there is this, you know, fear of giving up power or sharing power. There are a lot of intersections, as you explained, Lonnie, but I think the undercurrents, depending on the environments that you're in, whether it's the workplace or whether it's in your community or whether it's, you know, regardless of where it is, there is a gap in how we really welcome others and embrace others. And that's really a driving force. And the undercurrent of that is just fear.
I would add to that and say that it's common with checking the box. So that's very keeps everybody comfortable. If you're checking the box and you only have one or a few, then you remain comfortable. And that's a real challenge in every aspect, because we look on the websites and we see the diversity statements. We
and read the photos. Those
and we see the photos, stock photo. that they've chosen,
because these two black people I see on everybody's website, but they work everywhere.
And it really is a sad statement, because it's not representative of the organization itself.
So I want to ask you both, and I'm going to lead in with some of this. Have you had the experience of being the only or one of few, and what was it like? So when I've thought about this even for myself, I thought my answer would be no, because I've worked for mostly minority majority organizations. But I remember once when I was a VP that I was the only black man who was in a position of power and authority in the organization. There were no other black men who were in a management role or directors. Most of them were behind the scenes. So I was the only black man who was sort of frontline to see that. And I didn't really think of it as a really big deal at the time. There were other black women who had leadership roles there. But I remember that there were a group of people, constituents that we served, and they always referred to me as Vice President Morris. It was never Mr. Morris, because I wasn't doctor then. It was never Lonnie. It was always Vice President Morris. And it was only in reflecting on it, I recognized that that role, that position, that visibility was so important for them to see. It was greater for them than it was for me, because they didn't see themselves represented in other spaces. So they held on to that and all the time. So have either of you had the experiences of being the only or one of the few? And what was that like?
I will say yes. Underscore that 100%. I moved from New York to small town Pennsylvania, and I was one of a few black students in high school. And even though we had community, still to be one of a few in an institution or in a town, you stand out. You stand out intentionally or unintentionally. You can own it or you can ignore it. It can be empowering, and sometimes it can be disempowering. It all depends on the situation. In the workplace, I've found myself at times, yes, being the only, right? You're the only brown person, or you are the sole voice of wisdom around driving inclusion. And so it there's a burden that you carry and there's a gift that you have. And I think that the balance is, when do you play which role, which you're trying to drive. But being a lonely only is a struggle at times.
It really is. I'm just sitting here thinking about which one do I want to share? There are so many, and I've had so many awful experiences. And I think one that I want to share is I was the only in the actual department. And every time there was a function in the organization that celebrated African American history, African American people, the Black organization within the company that was put together to recognize and give us a safe space to help each other. Whenever they had a function, we had major mandatory meetings. Mandatory. Every single time. Every time. And so not only do you deal with microaggressions all day long, right? When you do have the opportunity to get away to the safe space, to be with other people who you would feel comfortable with having these conversations with, it was a mandatory meeting, so I was never able to attend. And this company was so blatant about me being the only one that when I went on a tour of the company, I never saw anybody who looked like me until I went to the warehouse.
Oh.
And I knew it was a problem. I knew that was a problem. So they were very used to it. They were very comfortable. And in retrospect, I think they thought I should have been happy that I was the chosen one.
I'm sorry for laughing.
It's real. It's, okay.
It's not funny. It's laughable when we think about it now, right? In hindsight, with what we know and how we approach things. Bernard, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I like the chosen one.
No,
because you know it goes back to what I said. It's a blessing, it's a blessing or a curse or a gift or whatever case may be. You were the chosen one in your situation. We all are. It's just how do we feel when we realize we are the only one and we're the only voice? How do we use that opportunity? And sometimes we take that risk. To call it, and then sometimes we don't. And that is, I think that's the double-edged sword of being the chosen one.
Mm-hmm. It is, yes.
It's a superpower. So let's try this. And because I think when we're dealing with being the, and I love this, Bernard, the lonely only, or the one of few, that it can feel like eggshells sometimes, trying to figure out this, and there are a lot of, say, faux pas that happen in these spaces. And so I was reading Forbes earlier this week, and there's a great writer, journalist out of Los Angeles, and I read her stuff all the time, Maya Richard Craven. And she says, there are three things you should never say to a Black colleague. Now, this list, we're going to add to this and do our own list, but I think there are two that sort of stood out to me. One's sort of laughable, I think. Cannot touch your hair. So I already know that. And Dr. Wendy, we talk about your hair all the time on this show. And then, but the two that I think sort of get at the crux of what we know these experiences are like are, one, you are so articulate. And then the last one is, where are you actually from? So there's sort of this othering in both of those statements. But I'm asking both of you, what are the other faux pas that we want our potential allies and our partners in the organizations and the other people we're trying to protect? What are the other faux pas you want people not to cross these lines? These are things to not do.
How about when I have on a sleeveless top and you accidentally touch my skin and you're so surprised that my skin is soft that you just can't help yourself but say, oh my gosh, your skin is so soft.
Wait. Let me tell you what.
Bernard and I could never wear a sleeveless top to work. So I was already going, well, what is happening here? Where is this? What world is this? But I forgot. Women can do that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you wearing a sleeveless top to the office. We got to talk. But
I'm a lifeguard.
There you go.
All right. So we know Dr. Wendy uses lotion. So we get that. So what else is there?
I think it's calling out, especially in a corporate setting, any of your accessories. In some settings, there's the look that you're supposed to have, and you have that nice watch, or you have suit. I remember a good friend of mine sharing a story with me that he's in a room with all these executives, and they get along, they all been working together. But anyway, the leader of the group looks over to him and notices his watch. And I guess the leader realized that the watch that the leader was wearing, was not up to par to what my good friend was wearing by a couple of thousand. And so my buddy, let me know. He's like, I'm not going to wear that watch to the office anymore. Right? I don't want these folks to feel a certain way.
Yep.
Or have a certain perception. So let me just control it. And so, you bought it for a reason, and we all do things for a reason. And at times you feel like maybe I'm letting them in on the game a little bit too much. So let me just kind of like slowly, level set a bit. So I share that story because I get it, and I probably would have done the same thing. But on the other hand, it's like, the bravado that you and your peers have and everyone else in that room is supposed to have, you can't celebrate in that. And that can be a shutdown as well. So just wanted to call that out.
Wow. We're paying you too much money.
There you go.
Right. If you can shop where I can.
Wait a minute. You took the tour down in the basement, didn't you? You should not have on a watch that costs more than mine. I remember being in an executive meeting once and one of the executives says, I think I'm the only person in here who doesn't drive a BMW. And at the time, I was an executive too, and I drove a BMW. But it felt very targeted at me, and I was new to the organization. So how did you get to have this and be on par with these other people? So not only was I the only Black male on that executive team, I was also the youngest. I was the only person in Gen X. So was this weird sort of othering of what you have and how do you fit here and why do you deserve to be on par with this?
And please, please, please don't think because we are going to do lunch and it's going to be potluck that I'm going to bring fried chicken and greens. That this is going to be your one chance to have soul food. Right?
Dr. Wendy, please bring catfish to the podcast.
That's a negative.
Okay. So let's try this. I know when you're the lonely only or one of the few, that some of the things we're talking about are challenges that can be amplified. They may not be unique unto us as people of color, but other people experience them, but when we're just the one or one of the few, it feels like all the eyes are on us all the time. So I'm wondering how do we protect ourselves in these spaces? And here's what sort of inspired this question. I looked at a report from Randstad, Canada, actually, and they do a lot of, it's a, HR company, and they do a lot of reports on what's happening across the space. And so there's some everyday challenges that Black employees encounter at work. And it includes being systemically excluded from opportunities, that your authority is often disputed, that if there are inclusion policies, and I'm glad Bernard's here to help us with this, that they may not meet your needs. And you already mentioned this from Bernard, being expected to be the voice for the entire community that you represent. And then ultimately, there are multiple unrealistic expectations. So how do we protect ourselves in these spaces when this is the wall that we're up against?
That's a good question. There are a lot of different approaches you can take. And let me first, start with the unrealistic expectations. I think one of the things we have to own is having a candid conversation of expectations of us, like with your manager, and really documenting that. Because the trick in the game we have to be mindful of is people get ahead by, being a chosen one. People have the capabilities of navigating, the invisible power structures because they've been savvy to identify them. And then the last piece is how they document it. And I call the documentation out because I think that is really powerful to go back to your manager or go back to the organization and said, we agreed on this. I delivered on A, B, C, and D, and you haven't delivered on your end. And that puts pressure on the organization because there's somewhat of a contractual agreement. And when you violate that, then there needs to be some action taken. So I had an experience early in my career when I asked for a raise. And I remember my manager told me, well, we can't do it right now, but we can do it in mid-year. And I wrote that statement down and I waited until mid-year came around. And I went back and I said, I'm following up. I've been doing, X, Y, and Z. I've been recognized. I've been on these committees. I'm coming back to continue the conversation about getting an increase. And I remember she told me, oh, we can't, possibly put that in right now. And I said, well, you promised. You made a commitment that you couldn't do it back in December or January, but you can put that request in now in the summer. And so let me know what we need to do, who we need to speak with. And long and behold, she said, I'll get back to you. And 2 weeks later, I got that increase. I share that with you because it's holding ground, it's documenting, it's being clear, and it's kind of, letting people know that you're committed to who you are and where you're trying to go because you're following up. You didn't just let it slide. And sometimes we get quiet in spaces where we need to be heard and be reminding our fellow colleagues that we do exist and we add value.
I love that. Not to get quiet, follow up, you need to be heard, and don't allow their excuses or delays to take you off that path. I love it. Looks like we might have lost Dr. Wendy for a second. That's okay. She'll hop back on with us.
No problem. No problem.
Wait. There she is.
I'm back.
Dr. Wendy, there you go. You have any thoughts?
I couldn't hear anything. Sorry. I missed the goodies.
Oh. Well, so we're talking about managing and protecting ourselves from the unrealistic expectations when you're one of the few or the only. Dr. Wendy?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what did I used to do? It's probably nothing that I really want to share because I have grown from that. but being the only has always been difficult. And I did find people outside of the organization as mentors to help with that. You know how we talk about the external board of directors to help you work that through.
Yes. Can I add to that?
Sure.
That is a very critical point. I had a colleague or a good friend of mine tell me that a role that they went for and obviously ended up getting the job, during an interview process, the individual was really identifying who can be a mentor, who can be an advocate for me when I join. And I was like, oh, that's smart. I never even thought about interviewing someone for that role to be my sponsor or whatever the case may be. But this individual did and approached, I think they said after the interview process or shortly after they received the offer, approached that leader and said, hey, would you be willing to mentor me to help me get acclimated to the organization? And that was very impactful for that individual's success in the role. And so I think there are things that we can do, but for some reason, we don't really learn all the tips and tricks. We kind of pick up these secrets and tools of success randomly, but that board of directors is key and critical. The challenge for us is how do we build that board?
Yeah, I appreciate that so much. And I know that that's not something that I heard a lot about when I was a student, either as an undergraduate or as a graduate student. So it was sort of fumbling through it as a professional and figuring it out, because I also ended up working in spaces where that wasn't part of their culture. It wasn't the natural thing to do. It wasn't the intentional thing to do to pair you with someone who could help you navigate this and help you and shepherd you through the process. You sort of have to discover those people on your own and build relationships on your own and figure out what it meant to have a professional mentor in the space. So I'm glad that there are people, and there were people in your life, Bernard, who mentioned that at the outset, who wanted to create that as a standard for how we operate.
Can I also say here too that, you know, the whole time I worked, I went to school. I mean, I was always pursuing my education at the same time. And classrooms now look very different than they did when I sat in that seat on the other side, because these conversations didn't take place. I remember being in class and I would say, oh, that's that theory they're using on me. What? But as far left me kind of stunned, but we didn't have frank conversations like this to help share the experience in the classroom and gain this knowledge. It was really exposure, getting out, being in different organizations. I was always a volunteer in the community in something. And so those are places that I found my networks to help me. The classroom now is very, very different, but that wasn't the case. And I wish it had been, because it would have helped me out in decision-making when I encountered these kinds of challenges.
Yeah, I agree. I think if you look back early in our careers, there was still this, you know, there's a lane that you're in, and that's the lane that you stay in. I mean, you can jump to the next lane, but you got to be ready for it. And we're having these conversations now because the gift of COVID, right? We're much more frank now. Right. No one can deny that there is racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, and all these other isms that are out there. So folks need to talk about it in the workplace. And I always share an insight that we talk about race, we talk about unfairness, we talk about a lot of things in our intimate circles. And I always use this example. And I talk to some leaders, I always say, after you have, you know, that birthday party or cookout, and, you know, it's 9 o'clock, folks are starting to wind down and roll out, I'm sure you pull out a bottle of wine, some cake or some whiskey,
and you sit down and you have conversations with, you know, from 50 people down to no more than 8 or 10 of your guests. And your guests can be as diverse as it is, and you will speak openly about your perspective on race, on, you know, poverty, or whatever the case may be. And you get up and everyone leaves. They're still your friends. You get a perspective, you learn something new, and you move on. But in the workplace, we still hold and stand our guard as if there's still a lane that people need to stay in. Or, you know, we don't understand what's going on in the world that is preventing brown people from getting to one level to the next. So I share that because the reality is we all have the conversation. It's just, where do we choose to have it? Who are the power structures willing to have those conversations with you? That to me is our biggest challenge. Let's just talk about it and let's find a solution. Let's solve for it.
And it's different in a workplace. Like you, if any other space you're in, you can walk away. But at the workplace, you can't. Rice University had a series of a team of researchers last year that conducted research and found that Black employees who faced microaggressions experienced higher levels of job dissatisfaction and burnout. Well, that's no surprise, right?
Yeah.
But, that's no surprise.
Something new on CNN. I didn't know about that.
But you know, that's their research showed that it's because most are not mentally prepared within ourselves to have those levels of conversations because of the backlash, because of what we end up feeling like. You know, how do we even initiate those conversations or respond in that way?
No, that's true. That's true. But I think when invited to those opportunities to speak up,
absolutely,
or be the only in the room, you got to take it. I recall one opportunity, one of my senior leaders invited me, you know, asked me if I play golf, and I said, nope. But he said, you know, if you want to, I will take you out and play golf. Wow. I know. I do play golf now. I'm not that good at it, but I miss that bonding opportunity to get to know the senior leader better. And it was just a genuine way of kind of trying to connect. That was his thing. So I think there are opportunities that we miss because of some of the barriers on both sides, right? How do you kind of build that relationship? How do you build that trust? And sometimes you just got to just jump in on both sides. You know, that leader that doesn't look like you or a colleague that doesn't look like you needs to just, you know, hey, let's go grab lunch together. That intimate moment right then and there to have lunch, there's a whole lot that comes out. You can have this conversation and you wouldn't even know.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I love that. And I think we can't have this conversation about taking up space, about being the lonely only or one of the few in the room without discussing the big elephant, right? And it's the big Black and or brown elephant stereotypes. So there's a study that just came out maybe 30 days or so ago in a journal called Group Processes and Intergroup Relations. And it's from a group of researchers at the University of Toronto. So follow me this. This is pretty, pretty fascinating stuff. They're looking at Black men, Arab men, and the intersectionality of age and sexual orientation as it relates to stereotype threat. So let me define that. So stereotype threat is really this notion of the experience that when you're engaged in a task, that you're aware of the stereotype people have about you and whatever your identity is that suggests you will not perform that task well. So we all deal with that in workspaces, right? But here's what they found at University of Toronto, that most of, so they asked people, let me say this, they asked people to list five words that they thought described a stereotype that was associated with this range of categories with Black and Arab men. So old men, young men, straight men, gay men, so the whole pairing of all of those. So what they found was that most of the bad stereotypes were associated with all the combinations of Black men. So Black straight men, Black men, old man, young man. And there was less negative stereotypes associated with the Arab men. But here's where it gets even more tricky. The Black men were stereotyped as athletic, stupid, tough, threatening, violent, immoral. When they paired that with old age, if it was an old Black man, he was also intolerant. But he wasn't considered dangerous or as stupid or as immoral or as threatening. When they looked at Arab men, they were stereotyped as controlling, extreme, intolerant, and religious. But when they were asked about young Arab men, they were less controlling, but they had increased ideas about them being terrorists.
Oh, Lord.
So I frame it this way to ask you this. So if we know that this is how they see us, and we show up as the chosen one, as the lonely only, as the one of few, and here's what you know they think about us, how do we safeguard against that? And how do we build allies and allyship in spite of these this thinking?
Is that research new? I mean, this sounds really like it should be, late 70s, early 80s.
Exactly, right? For this to be from this year,
okay,
this is tough.
Well, look,
but we also see the time clock turning backwards with situations politically, mm-hmm. right? In the workspace, things are the hands on the clock are turning backwards.
Yes, I also look. I think that perceptions are passed down, and if someone were to tell you something as a young person, you probably will then go ahead and apply that assumption to everything else you see. And then you also create your own story and narrative. And that's a huge challenge, right? How do you change a narrative that you get within your community? Right? Who do you fare? Who do you date? Where do you travel? And I think that that's just one aspect of it. There are many others, but I think that's the starting point, because once you're given that lens, once the cat is out the bag, it's out the bag. And so the challenge is for an individual to revisit those assumptions as they go through life. But for some of us, it's permanent. Like we just believe it just because, that favorite uncle of yours is the gospel to you.
Learned behavior.
Correct. 100%.
Learned behavior.
So how do
you...
go ahead. I was going to ask, how do you unlearn? But I'll let you have
that. No. I actually wanted to go back to the Rice University research. One of the participants told a story, and they said, I was being mistaken for a football player by some administrative assistant. A Black man working in the Midwest reported this. And he said, I felt upset because the commentary suggested that Black men, especially of my size, are on college campuses for athletics and nothing more. I simply told her that I am not a football player, and that I am also not a student, but a professional that works here, and that not all Black males on campus play sports. Now, that's at a higher ed institution, right?
Oh, we all know that story. I was a star academic on full academic scholarship when I went to visit. I won't say the names of some of the institutions, these very elite, prestigious institutions, with my father, two Black men walking to the office, and I was racking up academic scholarships all around. And I sat in one place in D.C., and the first thing they said was, well, what sport do you play? First of all, man, I'm 5'6", about 135 at that time. There's no sport for me. Badminton. What are you talking about? I'm here about these books.
Yeah, you know what's sad is there is this is attraction to, you know, associating brown people to sports and only sports. I remember one company I worked at, we were interested in an individual, and the individual just happened to be like a double major, you know, going for his JD, MD, or something of that nature. And he was talented, but he also a Division I football player. And all I can hear is, you know, the recruiters talking about this person, how great, how talented, how smart. They really wanted him to come to the company. And so anyway, we had this big, you know, event just again to meet all the prospective students. And I pulled him aside and I asked him, you know, what's your interviewing experience like so far with us? And he told me, all we do is talk about football. We don't talk about anything else. Mm. And we don't talk about, can I do the job? Not do the job? What is my interest?
That's sad.
And I was surprised. I was really blown away by that. Obviously, the person ended up not choosing to accepting their offer, but it just reminded me on, you know, people are either starstruck, people are attracted to one aspect and they forget the bigger picture. And in that situation, you're trying to get talent to come and do some good work at your organization. So I share that because some things just don't change, and what people are attracted to, what makes you stand out. And in this situation, you have a talented individual who just happens to be Division I. Obviously, you know, some of the people who are interviewing a student are sports fans, and they're not great athletes, so maybe they're attracted to that. But there's a lot that we leave on the table, right? And that was a missed opportunity. Like, if we could have really recruited the individual. So I throw that out there just because, again, you know, my role is, how do we prevent that from happening again? How do we really, you know, get it in people's minds that it's nice you want to talk about one aspect, but you're asking them to come and join the company to do X kind of work. And it's a dating process. They got to like us and you got to like them, but you like them more than they like us.
And I like that.
Vote me off this island. I can't take this.
So yeah, that was a mind blowing experience to go through. But again, it just reminded you, as you both were sharing, it just reminded me of the buckets that we seem to be put in at times when the stakes are high and we leave so much money on the table because we're attracted to one aspect of a person's identity.
that actually limits us, right? In all that we offer, in all that we bring to the table, it's another way of exclusion.
Indeed. Indeed.
It's another form of exclusion. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I want to pose this question, because we talk about a lot of the challenges with being this, the one person, and figuring out how to take up space and how to safeguard. But I want to also offer that sometimes there's, well, at least ask two of you as the experts, is there value in this, right? So sometimes being the only person of color in your office, there seem to be so many differences and so many ways that we are unalike. But I wonder, is there value in, and a sister who writes the blog, The Muse, says, there's value in embracing the similarities rather than focusing on the differences. I want to get your thoughts on that. And what are some of those similarities that probably rise to the top that we should keep in front of mind?
Well, I mean, yes, we should embrace the similarities. But the reason why you probably hired me is because there's something else that I bring different to the table, right? You don't hire everyone who's just going to, in this day and age, do the same job. And so I think it's really trying to embrace what that individual is bringing as different to the team. You know, if we all came to work in the same white, you know, button down and tight slacks and penny loafers, you know, what's the use? Like, that doesn't make sense. We all do the same job. When you can really leverage the opportunity of, what does Bill bring that's different? Well, Bill likes to present. Well, shoot, let Bill present, and then he can train us on how to present. And what does Sarah like to do? Well, Sarah is good at defending and arguing, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, she can make sure we get a bigger budget next year, right? That's the future state and how we want to build a team. I think, you know, in certain sectors, maybe there is this staleness and trying to rubber stamp and hopefully getting something different out of the process. And that's the challenge, right? We should embrace our similarities, but, you know, let's not over index on that. We should really be leaning on what is different. Because if we're all doing the same thing, we're boring.
So I hear that, Dr. Wendy.
Yeah, I think I'm more on yes, embrace the similarities, but I also think that we need to showcase our differences and showcase them in the manner that was just spoken of. Okay, so. Just because you're different doesn't mean you're wrong. Just because you're different doesn't mean it's not going to work. And sometimes it means, you know how we were with kids with show and tell? Sometimes you're being different. They just have to see that it really is an advantage. So I am one who really promotes that nonconformity in a good way. Right, in a good way, and bring out sometimes conflict will lead to resolution in a good space at the right time. And that's the balance that you find in these spaces as the only. Sometimes you don't have to say anything at all. And then there's a time when you have to have your voice and be heard. But I really think, yes, we're always going to embrace the similarities, but look at the differences in a different way. I'm not saying to hold back on that at all. I think we need to shine, make it fit, and move with it.
Yeah.
This is why I love it.
I was going to say, one of the things and this is a mentor asked this of me, and I always ask a lot of folks, do you know why you're here? Do you know why you've been hired?
I know what your job is, but do you know why you're here? And I remember one of my mentors asked me the same question, and I was stuck. Right? Mm. And because you got the job, but you don't know why you are really in the role. What is your role that you're supposed to play? Not the, just the description, but why did they pick you? What else are you bringing to the table? You know? And I think that is very critical as we navigate these spaces, especially as organizations are shifting how they do business and so on and so forth. There is a reason for why you've been selected. There's a reason for the role you are in. And there's a reason for how you will attract, you know, others to invest in you. But you got to figure out, like, why am I here?
So let me tell you why I love this. Because I am divergent. And I know, Dr. Wendy, I know that I can create conflict, creative conflict. I know that I push back on status quo. I know that I bring something different. I understand, Bernard, why I am here. And as I listen to both of you, I feel seen, and I'm sure that other people who are listening to this feel seen. But I also recognize that that's the significance of the access point. All the conversations that we've been having and talking about that people don't get to have, that they miss, that they've got to stumble and learn with themselves in the organization, that's why we bring this here. I think we've learned so much today. For employees, we've established that being the lonely only can be positive or negative, and you have to decipher which part of that you embrace. We want employees to think about, what do you do when you are the chosen one? Because there is much responsibility associated with that. And figure out, how do you use that opportunity? I love this from this story, Bernard. What does your watch say about you? And this is watch metaphorically. It's the other thing, whatever it is. It's your car, it's your shirt, it's your shoes. What are those things that you bring into the space that are part of how you identify? What are they saying about you to the other people as they're watching? We want to make sure that you are documenting the unrealistic expectations and following up with things that you've agreed upon with your superiors and your managers. Here's what I delivered. Make sure you document what you delivered, the opportunities you're supposed to get associated with that, and hold them accountable. Have you held your end of the bargain up? Get things in writing, follow up all the time. We've given this advice before multiple times on the Access Point. Seek out mentors who can help you through that. Create your own external board of directors. Understand your networks and how to magnify their impact and leverage them collectively to propel your career. I love this question. Do you know why you are here? Not just your job description, but why were you selected? And what's the role that you're playing? What do you bring to the table? When we think about this from a lead, for our leaders and our managers and supervisors, be careful of othering with your questions and comments about people's personal looks, about their skin, Dr. Wendy, about their hair, about their cars, about their watches. Be accountable. Make agreements with your employees and deliver on those. Keep your word. Your integrity is always on the line. Think about how you can create opportunities for Black and Brown people to connect with you. Even, and Bernard explained this to us, even if they don't play golf, that could be the area they can't connect, but find other ways to do that. Think about what you are leaving on the table as a leader if you only see someone for this one X, the isolated X that they bring. So if you only see them as the Division I athlete, you're missing out on all the talent they have as it relates to how to move your organization forward. Recognize, acknowledge, and amplify what everyone brings to the team. This allows you to align people with their strengths and the team or organizational needs, develop the competitive advantages, and showcase the differences. For our groups and teams, who are you having the after cookout conversations with, where you can be honest and frank about your beliefs, your values, and your experiences? how do you revisit assumptions as a community that people bring into the organization and then create safe spaces to move beyond those? From an organizational perspective, remember that there is still a divide. We have not conquered it all yet. There is fear associated with giving up power and giving away power, which is why we get some of the pushback and the weird things that happen in the space where people try to take up. Even when there is community with the few, they still stand out. So figure out ways to include them and to embrace them. Are you keeping up with the employees' expectations of you? And this is something we talk about all the time. And all the organizations I work with, there's always an issue of what the employee expects versus what the organization expects. And sometimes the organization falls short. Actually, a lot of times they fall short. The perceptions are passed down. We talked about multiple research studies looking at perceptions. Perceptions are passed down. So from an organizational perspective, how is your organization dismantling those perceptions and creating new narratives about your organization, your work, and the people that you bring to be part of the organization, your employees? And lastly, how do you help employees unlearn bad behavior and bad habits that influence how they work with others? This is a deep show, man, and I'm excited about our own personal reflections on this. And we always ask this at the Access Point. If the people listening decide not to heed any of the advice and the recommendations and the warnings that we set forth in this conversation, what is the tax? What is the black and brown tax that they pay for not paying attention? Bernard.
Wow. I mean, the tax is the burden for a lot of us. You know, people share their wisdom. It's what you hear and what you apply. And it's sometimes hard to apply something new and own that. So, you know, I think it's important just to take the baby steps on whatever tips and tricks that you've heard here or in any other place. Just know that, you know, you apply them when you're ready, and hopefully it becomes a strength at some point. But know that people have already blazed a trail, and others have, what we are sharing are either our own experiences or the stories that we've collected along the way. And we're just paying it forward. And, you know, this is such a great platform for us to kind of, to get that insight. So I hope folks would heed and also understand like the time and the value of just free information on how to manage your career, how to navigate your career to get you where you want to go. So,
yeah, thank you. Dr. Wendy.
Yes, I would think that for those who choose not to take the advice and what is freely given from our hearts, from our experience, I think that if you experience any pain, isolation, you still have that space to reach out. You still have that space and time to come back, hit the podcast, listen to it again. You know, I think it's hard when you're in it to think that you're in it, because you always feel that you know better, but the experience stings. And so I would hope that you don't want to stay in that space, but to move forward in your career, in your own personal development, that this space is for you, and you can take the advice and use it.
And I think being the only or one of few is a unique experience. And for many of us, it's majestic that it's in some ways you're the unicorn, right? That's this mystical character with these magical traits that you bring to the space. And many of us, even if you have an experience being the only person of color or one of few at your organization or at a previous organization, you are going to be the one or one of the few of something in every space in which you step.
acknowledging that, embracing that, and figuring out how to navigate that successfully will pay it forward all the time. And you'll get to hear people like Dr. Wendy and Bernard on your path as they're reaching back to say it was all worth it. We appreciate you. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. We discussed a lot. Let's keep this conversation going. You can listen to The Access Point wherever you get your podcasts. Like, share, comment, subscribe. If there was something that really resonated with you tonight, or you got a lingering question, you had an aha moment, you got thoughts for a future discussion, use the hashtag TAP Reflections. That is, TAP is in The Access Point. TAP Reflections across all the social media to let us know. If you want to join us live, you can tap in with Twitter Spaces on Thursdays at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Have a good night, everybody.